I'm really thrilled to be here with all of you. Please sit down. And I've had some of the difficulties that you get in old age. I remember I met a famous and much loved missionary years ago, and he told me, "Well, I'm suffering from a fatal disease." I sort of looked at him pityingly, or sympathetically or something. He said, "For old age." I'm going to sit because this thing that I have has made me a little uncertain in my balance. So if you can see me, I hope it'll be good enough. I want to talk today about Sanatana Dharma, East and West. Now you may think the influence of India on the West. That's not what I'm going to talk about. Hinduism is a name that was bestowed by foreigners on India because they thought of it as the Indus Valley. But in fact, Sanatana Dharma is not Hinduism. Hinduism is Sanatana Dharma, and there's a big difference. Sanatana Dharma means that truth which underlies the entire universe. It is, if we want to understand it in this way, the most scientific thing available. Because physics made up its mind many centuries ago, a number of centuries ago, that they couldn't think about God because he couldn't be proved. And the result of that, because human nature is such a limited thing, is that deciding not to think about God, they don't believe in God. And the scientists never can take you very far beyond the physical universe. It's amazing, however, how much they have found out. And in just the last 100 years or less, people have begun to understand that this seeming solidity of matter is very different from what you imagine. It is not solidity. It is energy in a rate of vibration. And if you wonder how can energy bring you something that looks so solid, once you understand that it's energy, what you have basically, you can even compare it with something quite simple, the rotation of a propeller on an airplane. If it's fast enough, you don't see the propeller, you see a disc. Or if you take the tines of a tuning fork and strike them, it'll look as if they're solid between certain points, but it's not so. It's an appearance. And when you think of this world as being composed of myriads and millions of these little different vibrations, then you can begin to understand. And it raises naturally the question, who are we? How do we get back to where we were? Everything is made by God. This is the second great delusion of modern science, that they have come at it from the material standpoint. Well, matter cannot give you the whole truth. What you must understand is that everything is consciousness. And this statement, which seems a bit extreme, is very understandable when we think of consciousness becoming will, becoming energy, and then matter. The age we have come into now, and I'm not going to justify this to those of you who have been brought up with the thought that this is Kali Yuga, but our Param Guru, Swami Sri Yukteswar, who was a great astrologer and astronomer, not just a great master, when a master like that talks about something like this, saying that that's wrong and this is right, you have to accept what they're saying because they talk from God consciousness. And he said that we came into Dwapara Yuga in the year 1900. It was Dwapara Sandhya 1700. So we're really only 106 years into actual Dwapara Yuga, which means second Yuga. But in this Yuga, people are going to become more and more aware that the basis of everything is energy. That simple statement came out just in 1905, just the beginning of Dwapara proper. And more you will see that matter, that people, I mean, in society, their whole basis of thinking is the concept of energy. I've often thought of our guru as the avatar of the age of energy, of Dwapara Yuga, because all his teachings, if you want to understand his basic approach, it was all based on the idea that energy is the reality. The energy at the moment is hardly understood above the level of electricity. But the truth is that energy is much more subtle. When God created the universe, he had to bring it, first of all, as I said, out of his consciousness. Then he had to vibrate that consciousness more deeply into thoughts. He is consciousness. Thoughts are what is known as the causal or ideational world. When that energy was right, when that consciousness was right, the ideas were right, then it was vibrated more grossly into the astral universe, which is made of energy. And then it was vibrated most grossly into the form of matter, which seems solid, although it isn't. But if you're sitting on a chair and have not sunk through that chair, you have to understand that the the astral energy is a different rate of vibration. All the atoms in your body are different rates of vibration. For that reason, I can't put my hands together or bring them into an appearance of solidity. I mean, into a movement that seems real, because it can't. It can't be that. Everything is matter. Everything is energy. Everything is thoughts. Everything is consciousness. This is how it was all stepped down. Well, science can take you very deep into that one. And the trouble is that people have always thought that religion is a question of belief. A scientist in China, India, America, Germany, Switzerland, all of these different things, if a person really discovers a scientific truth, there's no argument about it. They may contest his proofs, because some proofs are not proofs, but he has to understand that everything really is that cosmic energy. And so the truths of religion have to be of that type, or you can't really call them scientific. And we have the proof, and energy is what helps us to get that proof. I would like to read from a new book that I have written, and it's finished now, and we're just getting ready for publication. And is Dana here? Dana, you're right at the back. I think we're going to use your picture. She's the same one who did the painting for the cover of the Gita. And she will... It fits the same style. So this cosmic consciousness was, again, something that science discovered, not consciousness, cosmic reality. They discovered it quite amazingly. This universe is not centered in this little earth. Everything is round, everything is infinite, and they have discovered that the universe, as we know it, the physical universe, is a limited, it's an infinite but limited reality. It's infinite in the sense that there are something like 100 billion galaxies. Who's counting at that point? But that infinity of everything is the reality that we are trying to achieve. Reality is cosmic consciousness. And when you understand that the way to that cosmic consciousness is energy, then you quickly see that what the masters have talked about and what people understand variously in the different parts of the world is that religion is not just a question of Hinduism, Christianity, Buddhism, Islam, etc. The Sanatana Dharma is the religion of the universe. Why? Sanatana Dharma means eternal religion. And in this eternal religion, you have a totally different concept from Christianity, Hinduism, Buddhism, etc. It's all actually one truth. And religion, only religion, can take you to the very basis of truth. And the next basis of that is that it would be conceivably possible to... Well, I would say, first of all, let's say it would be impossible to learn everything there is about the atom looking at it from outside. But if you could understand that atom right to its depth, its central meaning, then you can see that your own self is the only atom you'll ever know. So it has to be self-realization. Self-realization is a very good name for the religion of the world. And each one has his own take on it, just as scientists also have their own schools, but less so. However, the vastness of religion is universal. Sanatana Dharma, or self-realization, is something that exists on the most distant planet in the most distant galaxy. It would have to be just as scientific truths. It doesn't matter whether a scientist is living in India or in America or on Mars. It would be the same truth. It would have to be, because matter is all a manifestation of the same basic realities. So I've written this book, and I'd like to read to you a little bit from this, because I feel this is sort of my major contribution. The Gita was great, but it's all there. I was just explaining it. This one is called the Revelation. It's called Revelations of Christ, proclaimed by Paramhansa Yogananda. And I'm going to go through what I just said, first of all, in chapter 2. Sanatana Dharma is a Sanskrit term meaning the eternal religion. Sanatana Dharma has for long ages been the accepted name in India for the universal truth, God, creator and sustainer of the universe, every atom of which, being conscious projection, is destined eventually to merge back consciously into the Supreme Spirit. You might say, well, no, I won't go into that now. Hinduism, the popular name for India's ancient religion, was imposed on that country by foreigners in relatively recent times. Hinduism is actually a misnomer. For one thing, Sanatana Dharma belongs not only to India, for it is the eternal truth underlying all manifested existence. The religion it proclaims is universal and must be considered to be as essential for some planet in a distant galaxy as for our own Earth. Sanatana Dharma is basic to every true religion of man. It should therefore be understood that divine truth has nothing to do with separative or sectarian beliefs. Sanatana Dharma is not a man-made religion, but explains rather how God brought all things into manifestation and how every soul, each one a prodigal son, can return and merge back into him. Sanatana Dharma is not itself a revelation, for it has to be expressed verbally, and words can be misleading. Rather, the eternal religion is the fruit of revelation, for it shows people how to achieve for themselves the inner revelation of the highest truths. The fundamental truths of Sanatana Dharma can be perceived by everyone who has the willingness to offer himself up completely to God in deep humility and devotion. Sanatana Dharma then concerns that divine revelation which all true saints have described: infinite light, sound, love, bliss, power, calmness, and wisdom. They have described it also as Saint Paul did when he spoke of the peace of God which passeth understanding. When Saint Teresa of Avila announced once to her priestly confessor that she'd had a vision of the formless Christ, the priest, who until then had been her staunchest defender, began to doubt her. His faith, however, in her deep spirituality impelled him to search the matter, to research the matter, and he was led at last to discover, in the writings of Saint Thomas Aquinas, a surprising truth. Visions of Christ without form, he learned, are indeed higher than any vision with form. Paramahansa Yogananda often cited this story. What can St. Teresa of Avila and later on Yogananda have meant when they spoke of the formless Christ? If we think of the universe, the material universe, as comprising the vast number of galaxies that science claims, over 100 billion of them, the question must arise in the minds of even the most devoutly Orthodox Christian: how can God be like the popular image of an old man with a long white beard? In fact, I think that's the most common image held among Christians for God. The creator in the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel in Rome. Another question follows naturally: how can Jesus Christ himself really have been God's only son? Surely those concepts can be viewed only as quaint archaicisms. No form, however vast, could have projected the universe as we now know it to be. Of course, no anthropomorphic God could have projected a universe even the size people thought it to be when Jesus lived. The earth they knew then was relatively tiny, but even in that it was also infinitely complex, with countless flora and fauna, with populous nations, with a relatively vast territory, with innumerable unexplained stars in the heavens, with shifting seasons, winds, and climates in constant flux and repetition, and with the changing but constantly repeating positions of the constellations. The list might be stretched out indefinitely. Enough variety, however, has been suggested here already to show that the reality behind everything could not possibly be some individual brain, however divine. It would have, if anything, to be a formless consciousness. I remember when I crossed the Atlantic Ocean with my family by ship, a thing we did nine times during my childhood, back and forth between Europe and America. My father must surely have explained to me the phenomena I observed, though I don't recall whether he did it before or after my observation. No doubt it was really before, but let's see. I do clearly remember that other ships, as they approached us from a distance, didn't begin as tiny dots on the horizon that grew in size gradually on drawing nearer. What first appeared was the tips of their masts, which slowly rose up out of the ocean instead of merely increasing gradually in size. Next, the whole ship would rise out of the water until it became fully visible. The explanation for that almost abrupt appearance was, of course, the curvature of the earth. I can only believe that this phenomenon had to have been observed thousands of times before me, and long before people realized that the earth is round. Why didn't the people in the days of Jesus Christ and for centuries afterwards ask themselves the reason for this sudden appearance? The waxing and waning moon is something every human being with eyes to see has observed for thousands of years. You see when the moon is new, when it's completely dark, you can see the outline of the moon. You can see it on the part when it's a crescent moon. You can see the dim reflection on the rest of it. It's not that the moon grows bigger and smaller. Obviously, some things cause it to. Why didn't anybody think that before? Things that seem quite obvious to you and me, it just hadn't occurred. And there were brilliant people there. Let me just go on here because I seem to remember. How is it that no one until recent times related it to reflected light from the sun? Today, the solution seems obvious. In fact, you can see the shadow, and yet they didn't think of it. Why not? Why didn't anybody give reasonable thought to why the sun rises through the seasons at different points on the horizon, always repeating the same directions of change and always in the same sequence throughout the year? After all, brilliant men lived in those days. We today have no monopoly on intellectual acumen. I'll discuss in a later chapter the strange fact that a veil of varying opacity seems to obscure even brilliant minds. Could it be that man simply wasn't ready to perceive certain realities which to us nowadays seem so obvious? People for countless centuries were also aware of the mold that appeared on bread, but it wasn't until the 1920s that penicillin was discovered in that mold. And only in the 1940s did its use become widespread. The same may be said of countless other discoveries. The facts may have stared all humanity in the face, yet man wasn't ready to understand them, and perhaps wasn't even ready to observe them. Were people not sufficiently developed intellectually in those times to ask the right questions? Or did they make any new discoveries simply because the facts themselves had piled up so high as to be noticeable, thereby by making the questions inevitable? Whatever the case, another interesting phenomenon intrudes itself also. Many scientific discoveries have been made simultaneously by two or more people, sometimes at a great distance from one another. I have read, though other research I've done suggests otherwise, that if Charles Darwin had waited 1 week before announcing his On the Origin of Species by means of natural selection, Alfred Russel Wallace would have published a similar theory before him. From a religious point of view, Darwin's win by a nose was perhaps unfortunate, for Wallace's outlook was more spiritual. He also believed in things less purely material, for example, in psychic phenomena. Lobachevsky and Bolyai in Russia and in Hungary, respectively, discovered spherical geometry simultaneously and were ridiculed for a time as crazy. One is at least free to suspect that inspiration either passes from brain to brain or is perhaps dropped by divine and possibly angelic beings into minds that are prepared and receptive. As I said, I'll pursue this the curious phenomenon later of men's varying levels of understanding during different historic eras. It is fascinating to think that ability may advance and decline cyclically, almost like the seasons, though in different rhythms. For now, however, my theme must be limited to the fact that it is only recently, indeed in my own lifetime, that people have come to know enough to realize how vast the material universe is, and therefore to understand how utterly impossible it would be for any anthropomorphic being to have created it. I've said that yoga and Sanatana Dharma teach that everything came from consciousness. Here's a very interesting thought, that the size of the physical universe is not infinite. There's a certain limit to it, and beyond that, if you ask a scientist what's beyond it, he'll say nothing. You're asking questions that don't apply. But however, you know, there's only one thing that is exactly as big as it seems, thought. Once you ask the question and try to answer it, you've already expanded beyond those limits. So the physical universe is finite, but infinite by our present standards. And the union of everything, in fact, later on in this book, I go into a very interesting thing, the ego. Where did that ego come from? We seem so real to ourselves. And yet, if you analyze it very carefully, there cannot be any ego. It has to be a part of the infinite consciousness. We are reflections of that, and every soul is as great as any other because no soul is a soul. Every soul is just a manifestation of God. He is the one reality. That consciousness, you might describe it as being like a light that shines on little slivers of glass, and yet the sun is infinite compared to us. The little slivers seem like individualized consciousness. Why? Because we have built a circumference around our little definition of ego. The ego is individualized spirit attached to the body. And that individuality, which seems so real to each one of us, it's like center everywhere, circumference nowhere, a thing that that has been said long ago, and Master describes it that way in Autobiography of a Yogi. But that consciousness is also center in every atom. It's center everywhere, circumference nowhere. As far as our consciousness goes, that individual spirit is centered in each one of us, but we develop all sorts of separative self-definitions. So we think of ourselves as being American, Indian, Swiss, German, whatever. We think of ourselves as being male or female. We think of ourselves as being young or old. We think of ourselves in all sorts of ways, as bankers, as husbands, as wives, as fathers and mothers, and so on. All these are just our own self-definition, because you look out upon the world and see all those things related to you, and finally that becomes your center. Really, if you want to look at it in the deepest way, the whole path of Sanatana Dharma is to bring you beyond this consciousness of being this one person and realizing that you are infinite. Self-realization is the realization that that divine self is your reality. And the definitions that you've got are things that you have woven. So when I look at you, Vandana, you look like another person to me, and I suppose I look like another one to you. But if I look with divine eyes, we're not different at all. People are the same all over the universe. There has to be that truth. Otherwise, the universe couldn't exist. It all came into being out of a manifestation of this center everywhere, circumference nowhere. You'll notice, for example, that what was I thinking? Dash it! You know, this thing that I have now lately—it's just been 2 months now. I find it difficult to think clearly. And so I hope you'll forgive me for struggling with this thing so much, but it's called Meniere's syndrome. I'd never heard of it until I got it. And maybe if I'd known, I could have gotten out of it somehow. I'll go on reading and then come back to that thought. Let us consider that last question first. Is consciousness really something each of us produces by what scientists describe as a movement of electrons through a circuit of brain cells? Some aspects of awareness in human nature, it must be admitted, are universally true and therefore cannot be individually created. A happy baby has no need to learn how to smile. When it is distressed, moreover, it knows perfectly well on its own how to cry. These are very simple examples, but they show at least that certain tendencies in human nature are innate. Even dogs seem at least to be smiling when they wag their tails happily and manage to look ferocious when they are angry. Any child knows surely that when a dog is wagging its tail, it is being friendly. Many comparisons might be submitted to show how states of consciousness express themselves uniformly everywhere. When a person feels some positive emotion, such as happiness, he experiences a corresponding rise of energy in the body and in the spine. Accompanied by outward signs of that upliftment, he sits up straight, looks naturally upward, and curves the corners of his mouth upward in a smile. When, on the other hand, a person feels a negative emotion, such as unhappiness, he experiences a corresponding lowering of energy in the body and the spine. Accompanying that sinking feeling is a tendency to slump forward, to look down, to let the shoulders sag, even to walk heavily. Human bodies all have basically the same features and attributes. Tastes in the mouth are, it is fairly safe to say, more or less the same in all bodies. Sourness puckers the lips of everyone, and sweetness is all but universally pleasurable. Man, Jean-Paul Sartre declared, is radically free. His declaration forces the question, free from what? All human beings are born equipped with the same nervous system. They respond in ways that are basically uniform. The same things soothe or irritate their nerves. It has been scientifically demonstrated that electric wires react to stimuli in ways very similar to stimulation of the nerves. In Out of the Labyrinth, a book I wrote many years ago, I showed that even morality is rooted in certain universal realities of human nature. Why, for instance, are the words of Jesus Christ quoted by St. Paul in the Acts universally true? Remember, Paul wrote, the words of the Lord Jesus Christ, how he said, "It is more blessed to give than to receive." Is this statement founded in actual human experience, or is it simply a matter of blind belief? Experience shows, in fact, that the statement is universally true. One does indeed feel blessed, in other words, happy and perhaps even blissful, when his consciousness and feelings expand to include others in his reality. On the other hand, when one excludes others from that reality, his feelings withdraw into himself, and his sensitivity to object reality shrinks. The issue of consciousness is not limited merely to the abstraction, to that abstraction, consciousness itself. It includes feelings also. Indeed, our feelings are more important to most of us than is our ability to reason. It is stated that computers will someday be sophisticated enough to be conscious. The humble earthworm, however, is as simple a creature as can easily be observed, and the earthworm is obviously conscious. It is also self-conscious. If it is pricked, it tries to squirm away. Feeling, on the other hand, is intimately connected with a sense of self, whereas rational progressions are more or less mechanical and can be performed by mere computers. Consciousness, obviously, is not a product, in any case, of brain activity. It precedes the ability to think and reason. All allied to consciousness are two things which transcend even the ability to reason. That is feeling and self-awareness. That is why the definition that Swami Shankaracharya, Adi Shankara, gave of God is Satchidananda. Ever-existing, Yogananda translated, it's ever-existing, ever-conscious, ever-new joy. That ever-new was implied in what Shankar stated, but most people have not understood. That ever-new is something that you... the mind can think of, gosh, have I got to be the same through all eternity? You know, life is constantly new. I remember when I first heard the sound of Om in meditation, and it was so amazing to me that I knew with absolute certainty I could listen to that sound for all of eternity and never get tired. You can listen to earthly music, and it gets boring and irritating after a while. The nerves can only take so much. But when you merge into that, then suddenly you know that you could never get tired of it. Well, ever new is because it's always springing up new inspirations and so on. In fact, it's a very interesting thing that mankind, we know, first of all, that God is abstract and absolute and formless and all those things. But that consciousness produced us. He is impersonal in the sense of not wanting anything from us. He is very personal in the sense of being in each one of us and being able to experience our traumas, our joys, our fulfillments, everything. And that one thing, if you meditate on it, you'll see that, in a sense, God, who is certainly far above humanity, still has a very human aspect to the spiritual truth. It is something that individuals gain and can gain through. And this is the resolution that Yogananda gave of Sanatana Dharma. being the ultimate reality. Self-realization is the ultimate, and thus the clarification he gave us was that this human aspect is just as real. You can approach God, and you have to approach God from where you are. You can't think in terms of you've never experienced and never understood. But if you think of God as your divine mother, as Jesus Christ, as Krishna, as Shiva, and so on, all of these things, these abstractions, they're a human thing. You need humanity. You need to learn how to love other people in order to find the infinite. You need to think of God that way, as a human form. I mentioned in this book somewhere that when I was first beginning on the path, I'd never heard of God as the divine mother. I grew up in a very Christian environment. But when I first thought of Divine Mother, I thought, well, how can I visualize her? As Ram Prasad, the great Bengali saint of the 18th or 17th century back then, he said, Ore, shatta 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 ved taramar nirakara. God is without form and formless. He knew that. And then he goes on in the next line, but still I love to worship you in this form because his human nature could be satisfied by that. The time will come, and it has to come soon, not later if possible, but even later, it'll have to come to you. You have no choice. This is the one thing that's absolutely inevitable, that you will have to merge back into who you really are. You're not this human body. You are infinite. We can break down all those walls of self-definition that we have. When you can decide that I'm whatever comes, nishkam karma, whatever comes, let it be, have no desire for the fruits of your action, then you begin to see that this impersonal state that you get in meditation is also very personal. God cares for your joys, for your sorrows, for everything. And so on that level of the abstract universal, these personal truths are also there. How do I explain that? Really, I don't know. But the more you come close to God, the more you realize that that's a part of that reality. God created these things because it's a part of his reality. And he can change things, and that's why he too is ever new in his manifestation of the universe. So, what is the end? Sanatana Dharma, wait a minute, where am I? Sanatana Dharma declares that the essence of Supreme Spirit is Satchidananda. ever-existing, ever-conscious, ever-new bliss, as Paramahansa Yogananda translated the term. When the question was posed in that ancient teaching, why did God create the universe? The answer was given, he created it so that he might enjoy himself through many. What is the essence of that enjoyment of bliss? It is calm, limitless, unmoving yet ever-thrilling enjoyment of the essence of one's own being. Ever-changing yet essentially changeless. Ever-new yet eternally unaffected. Self-existent, uncaused, the supreme source of everything manifested. Absolute perfection, a fulfillment of perfect enjoyment beyond imagination of expectancy. Pure bliss is the fundamental, is the fulfillment of selfless love for the infinite self. God created the universe not merely out of his own consciousness, but out of his perfect love for the manifestations of infinite bliss in all beings. These are thoughts which science would never dare even to contemplate. They reveal the deep need of human beings everywhere for more than just the facts, please. We all need religion, if only because it stresses love above the countless scattered bits and pieces of intellectual knowledge. Why should we ever imagine that anyone else is radically different from ourselves? The same desire for love, leading to perfect bliss, is inherent in every human being. It could not be otherwise, for we all emerged like the prodigal son at the beginning of our roaming about in foreign lands, far from our one bliss God. How did God create us? That important question will be addressed in a later chapter, but what he did essentially was project us as his superconscious dream from infinite consciousness. Jesus Christ was sent to earth to proclaim the Heavenly Father's love for us all and to awaken love in our hearts for him. Science has shown us, however, a universe too vast to have been created by any human father figure. Science's view, too, however, is limited. Whatever or whoever brought everything into existence created also human beings with human feelings and with individual appreciation for parental love, filial love, romantic and friendly love. If that infinite one is conscious, then he certainly knows our innermost feelings. No matter how often science, with its dry, factual outlook on reality, may scoff at the idea of a being infinitely superior to the scientists themselves. For far beyond their intellectual games, lambent with tenderest feelings of love for us all, unceasingly forgiving and awaiting only our love to return, bring us back to himself. A scientist once said to Paramahansa Yogananda, "The universe is nothing but an aggregate of protons and electrons." "Granted," that great sage responded, "those protons and electrons are what we might call the building blocks of creation. But if you dumped a pile of bricks onto an open field, would they form themselves into a building? Don't you see it takes intelligent design to build buildings with whatever materials are at hand? And it takes cosmic intelligence to form the vast universe with its infinite complexity at every level of manifestation. How much more wonderful this view of a universe vibrant with compassion and with cosmic love, rooted in infinite bliss. Yes, of course there is pain and suffering also for us, prodigal sons, all. It is because in some way or another we have flouted this perfect harmony of our own being. Man's first reaction to suffering is often to harden his heart against pain by telling himself, for example, 'I'll never love again.' Bitterness may ensue. It is a distortion merely of essential feeling, or else one may try to deaden his ability to feel any emotion, in which case he becomes hardly more than a living corpse. For what is consciousness itself without feeling? It can produce no more than mechanisms. Such people were described by Jesus when he said, well, let me repeat the story. And another of his disciples said to him, 'Lord, suffer me first to go and bury my father.' But Jesus said unto him, 'Follow me and let the dead bury their dead.' How much more perceptive is that prodigal wanderer who says to himself, what I tried didn't work, let me now try some other way. Constantly seeking a positive solution, he comes at last to realize that after every disappointment, he is withdrawn into himself to regroup, so to speak. And the thought comes to him at last, maybe my answer lies not out there, but in myself. He returns at last then to his father's house and rejoices finally in his father's love and eternal welcome. Yes, of course there is more to life than an endless, dry desert, barren of any life, of any love, because all the plants have been pulled out of the ground, dissected and set aside for further analysis. Intelligent design has become a hot issue nowadays in the schools. I think the problem may lie with how the term itself is defined. Surely it ought not even to be a matter for debate whether the universe manifests conscious intelligence. The very fact that it takes considerable human intelligence even to demonstrate the universe has no intelligence must itself be considered the undoing of that whole argument. A woman informed me somewhat proudly the other day, women are more intelligent than men. She wouldn't even hear any further discussion on the matter, so I was happy to leave the subject as she had stated it. In this book, however, since I'm in control, I can say what I would have liked to tell her. It all depends on how you define intelligence. A long life has convinced me that women are indeed, in certain respects, more intelligent than men, and that men, in other respects, are more intelligent than women. Both types of intelligence are needed. Only thus can mankind form a more complete picture of reality. A man and a woman may be walking down the street. The woman says, what do you think of those shoes? The man answers, what shoes? On the lower shelf of that window we just passed, to the left toward the front. What window, the man asks. We need particulars, we also need abstractions. We need those things and concepts which appeal to our feelings. We also need to understand the why and the what of things. We need to both feeling and reason, in other words. We need enjoyment as well as understanding. Both are necessary. As Yogananda said, feeling must be kept in a state of reason, otherwise it becomes fanatical. Either aspect of our nature without the other would leave us incomplete. The question of intelligent design can be settled quite simply by deciding first what we mean by intelligent. George Gaylord Simpson, the eminent biologist, when discussing intelligent evolution according to his own definition of the term, considered anomalies of design in certain creatures as faulty from an engineering standpoint. And wrote this is a paraphrase, he wrote, would it not be impious to impute such fumbling to the Creator? Well, the answer is that his definition of intelligent design is altogether simplistic. So also, for that matter, are the fundamentalist expressions, are the typical explanations advanced by so many religious fundamentalists. Let us assume something that human arrogance usually rejects out of hand, an intelligence infinitely wiser than man's. God is both finite and infinitesimal. The fact that omniscience can embrace the vast universe in no way precludes it from embracing also each individual atom. And if omniscience can embrace the atom, why not embrace also the feelings of, well, if feelings can't be visualized as existing on an atomic level, then at least the feelings of human beings. Why is it so difficult to believe that God, in his love for mankind, should incarnate among men as a man himself? Jesus Christ himself described his inner consciousness as infinite. He said, where two or three are gathered together in my name, there am I in the midst of them. He didn't say that he'd get to all of them in time. He said, there am I. Christians sell short the very man they think of and pray to as their Savior. Jesus was and is the Christ. These are, I grant you, deep waters. We'll explore them further on as we proceed. I have to say that I have so many things I want to say in this book, and yet I have to lead the reader step by step. I'm very enthusiastic about this book. Another question raises its serpent hood, ready to inject us with a mental poison of doubt. if we neglect to address it honestly, the question becomes more pressing the farther back in time science pushes history. Did God really wait all those millennia before deciding to bring mankind? Excuse me. This is the supreme revelation through the teachings of Jesus Christ? If so, how can one fail to ask, was it quite fair of God? For in his case, countless generations passed before man could be given, quote, a true teaching, end quote, on how to reach heaven, which Jesus equated, as we shall see later, with God. Is this a true dogma? If so, doesn't the dogma contradict any claim of divine compassion? Christ's revelation was above everything else that God loves each one of us, his children. If God really does love us, why did he wait so long to tell us so? For it is now evident that human history didn't begin a few centuries merely ago, before the Christian era. Archaeologists have pushed human history back many, many thousands of years. Indeed, a discovery was made in the 20th century of the imprint of a sandal in sandstone, dating back, one assumes, millions of years. Another astonishing discovery was a nail found not long ago in America embedded in a block of coal. That block was formed many millions of years ago, yet within it was a man-made nail. Is all this, as certain fundamentalist Christians would have us believe, merely the, quote, work of Satan to confuse us? Surely if we want to achieve any insight into God's ways, we must try at least to use what intelligence he has given us. You can see I have fun writing. Many Christians convince themselves that when the members of other religions express devotion to God, or when they speak of God's love for man, they express sentiments quite different from those felt by devout Christians. Pagans, we are told, cannot experience Christian love. Well, do they think that love for Kali or Krishna has in some way to be different from true Christian devotion to Mary or Jesus? After Yogananda's visit to St. Teresa Neumann, he described having beheld also through her eyes the vision she received of the Passion of Christ. An article in a Catholic magazine, which appeared several years later, sneered, as if a Hindu yogi could have a true Catholic vision. The truth is, in fact, if the Pope can be considered infallible, he has to be the only true Christian. The truth is that even the bodily experiences aroused by deep yoga practice, a science related to universal human realities discovered in India millennia ago, correspond exactly to human nature everywhere. The upliftment of consciousness in the deeply meditating yogi is exactly the same as the ecstasies of St. Francis of Assisi and St. Teresa of Avila. Certain truth seekers in every age have loved and communed with God. It simply cannot be that Jesus Christ brought a completely new and divine and unique revelation to mankind. Had he done so, indeed, his very teaching ought to be suspect, for truth is Sanatan. Christian theologians notoriously rush in with the caveat that Christian grace is somehow special and quite different from anything pagan, which, according to them, is merely physical and not the result of divine grace. Mischievous is the word Yogananda used to describe such attempts to denigrate other religions. As scientists in Germany, America, China, and India work with universal material realities which never change from country to country and would not change even from planet to planet, so the truth also taught by Jesus Christ, Krishna, and Buddha is universal and should be heard and studied everywhere with equal trust and confidence. It is a travesty to treat forms of truth that seem different from one's own, like shop merchandise, which a salesman, eager to secure a sale, compares with other products to their disadvantage. Perceptive is he who, when considering a new spiritual teaching, asks himself first, is this teaching realistic in terms of my own experience of life? If he is perceptive, he will next ask himself, does it conform to the high truths taught through the ages by people of true wisdom? If it fails on both counts, it should be tossed aside as scripturally worthless. If, on the other hand, it at least conforms to actual experience, even though it is not true to the eternal verities, it may be considered from a point of view, at any rate, of how helpful it relates to human needs. If one is seeking true wisdom and isn't able to estimate the truth of a teaching from his own or from wiser experience, he should consider it cautiously. Probably it is a mere human invention. For as the electron, which is the ultimate building block of material creation, is basically the same everywhere, so life, aspiration, love, and fulfillment are the same in all creatures. I've lost my place here, unfortunately. That, albeit more consciously so in human beings, the truths of consciousness everywhere must be universally the same, and then, given all that we know of life, must also be eternal. Now, one thing which I go into in this book, but won't read from the book right now, is that in India, you have the only place in all religions where the followers at least have heard the word Kevalya Moksha. Kevalya Moksha is not an English word, so you might not expect English people to know it. However, the meaning of it is universal. In Christianity, people think that the height, I don't say Christ felt this, I don't say that Teresa Neumann, who spoke of the formless Christ, say these things, but most people think that heaven is a place where you go either, if you're good, and only and to hell if you're not good. But that's a relative term. In the heaven, in the astral heaven, your body is the same as you've got now. It's just made of light. Your personality is the same as you've got now. The only basic difference would be that everything is much more beautiful, everything is much more pleasing to the mind and the heart and everything. But basically, that's just a temporary stopping place. You might be able to get freed from all material karma, but then you still have astral karma and causal karma to work out. In this book, I mention a very interesting analogy, however. If you have a huge lake and it freezes over in wintertime, thousands and thousands of human beings couldn't press on it and break through it. But if wherever you're standing right now, you can drill through the ice and get into the water underneath, suddenly you find that you're in the water. And once you've attained that state, that's known as Jivan Mukta. Once you attain that state of freedom in yourself, freedom from ego, then you look back at all those other incarnations, you can get rid of them very easily because you're doing it from a standpoint of absolute consciousness. The Jivan Mukta still has all his memories when he was still a deluded, ego-centered human being. However, once you get rid of those definitions and are in spirit, you can see all of those. Even in one meditation, you can pay off the karma of one lifetime in vision, because you have to see all the things that you did, good, bad, indifferent. You have to see them as God acting through those different forms. In your lifetime, maybe in some incarnation, it was God the pirate who lived that way. In your lifetime, it may have been God the Rockefeller who lived that way. It's all God. He does everything. He talks through us. He does it all. But he's given us this little impulse of personality, of ego, making us think we are thinking it. You know, in the Gita explains that everything is a mixture of the gunas, the qualities of consciousness. And when you do good things and achieve good karma, you still can't get into infinite consciousness, because it's still with the thought that I've done good things. A saint, one who is in that consciousness of God, he doesn't see anything as being done by him. he may know he's got to act. You can't just sit back and wait for God to work through you. I know I've often told this story. Back in 1955, when I was first made the minister of SRF Church, I remember thinking well into my sermon that, well, Master told us we should let God act through us. So I thought, why don't I just shut up and let God talk? And I stood there, for 2 minutes. 2 minutes. If I were to be quiet here for 2 minutes, I think you'd all get a little scared, wouldn't you? 2 minutes. I was perfectly calm, but many in the congregation were sort of sweating, thinking I had frozen out of fear. No, I was just standing there comfortably waiting for God to talk through me. And finally I realized, well, he won't. I have to do it. Yogananda said, I will reason, I will, I will act, but guide thou my reason, will, and activity to the right path in everything. So to attain that state of freedom from ego brings you this realization that really it was he who did it all just through this veil of delusion. The moksha comes, first of all, jivan mukti and then the asabhikalpa samadhi. I remember my guru saying to me, you won't be completely safe until you achieve nirvikalpa samadhi, that state of absolute freedom from any self-definitions. I've also mentioned in this book that you can't get out of that by your own will, because your will is already poisoned by the delusion it's trying to get rid of. So you say, I am free. You're not. It has to be another I. The only way is through a guru. A guru's consciousness being infinite. If you get in tune with him, you can begin to see the world as he sees it. And you can understand that it's he acting through all beings, but not inwardly free from them. In other words, with with nirvikalpa samadhi and that realization, then you find that you become one with God. Now, somebody who achieves jivan mukta, even he is not free, as I said. But when you become a paramukta, a siddha, then you see perfection everywhere. You see that he is the only reality. And with that consciousness, as I was saying, it's much easier to dispel this illusion of separateness. It's all he, and yet he's created this fantastic drama, which seems so real. There's a question asked in the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam, which my guru wrote a commentary on. And in that, it says that, I can't remember the words exactly, but what Yogananda said was that what this is saying that is that people have come from infinity, but why is it so difficult? It seems so simple when you explain it that way. It isn't when you actually realize the truth. Because his consciousness, the guru's consciousness, infused into you, gradually you begin to see these veils lifting, and you begin to perceive all things as that one self, acting in countless forms. You know, Christians talk a lot about Satan, so do Muslims. And this is a truth, but Hinduism doesn't talk about Satan. So you see that every truth from every example from Sanatan Dharma is, it's true in a limited as well as an expanded way. So let me see if I can have, I'd like to read to you also from another chapter. This is whence the correction. I have said repeatedly that the saints everywhere are the true custodians of religion. What is to be done, however, when those saints are muzzled by their own churches, when they are ostracized and excommunicated by it, when a vast number of Christians scoff at the very need to listen to them? In Christianity, as it was officially practiced, sainthood is not, so to speak, in the driver's seat. Its authority is reined in, obstructed, and as frequently as not, denied by church authorities and perhaps by the majority of Christians also. Great saints have indeed lived on earth, appearing in every country, in every age, and in every religion. There are such saints on earth, true spiritual masters, even in these materialistic times. But how much are they able to say when people turn away from them with comments like, "Oh, your opinion seems sincere, but our experience of life is our own. Why should we listen to what you have to say?" People of true wisdom never try to impose their insights on others. As Jesus Christ counseled, "Give not that which is holy unto dogs, neither cast your pearls before swine." And Christian religion accords Jesus no sense of humor. What follows is the voice of common sense as well as of wisdom. The true author of the following commentaries, for whom I am, as I've already said, only a mouthpiece, was Paramahansa Yogananda. For nearly 60 years I have been his disciple. He showed himself to me convincingly as the greatest human being I had ever or have ever met. Yogananda wrote more than once, told us more than once, who had lived with him when he had been sent by his great spiritual teachers to the West. "The first in my line of gurus," he told us, Babaji, a great master in the Himalayas, recounted the following event to his chief disciple, Lahiri Mahashay. Lahiri Mahashay's disciple was Sirukteswar, and Yogananda was the disciple of Sirukteswar. Sirukteswar was the disciple of Lahiri Mahashay, Yogananda of Sirukteswar. Babaji stated that Jesus Christ had appeared to him and declared, "What has happened to my religion? My followers are doing good works, but too many of them have forgotten the essence of my teaching of direct inner communion with God. Let us together send again to the West the secrets for achieving that communion." Babaji then told Lahiri Mahashay what Jesus meant was the technique of Kriya Yoga, which helps the sincere seeker to unite his soul with God. Jesus Christ promised to send, through a disciple of Lahiri Mahashay, a yogi for special training. That disciple, Babaji said, would disseminate once again in the West the true message of Jesus Christ to the world. Swami Sirukteswar, Yogananda's own guru, declared to him, as is stated in Autobiography of a Yogi, "You, my son, are the one Jesus promised to send for training." Yogananda's message, as he often told us, was to bring back original Christianity. His further message, His further message was to make the public more once more aware of the original Hindu yoga as taught by Jesus, by Krishna, Babaji himself declared to Lahiri Mahashay, as was conveyed to his disciples, and as Paramahansa Yogananda conveyed to us, that he himself was the reincarnation of Lord Krishna, the divine expounder of the Bhagavad Gita. I was with Yogananda when he finished his commentaries on the Bhagavad Gita. He declared to me personally, "A new scripture has been born. Millions will find God through this work. Not just thousands, millions. I have seen it. I know." There has always been a subtle link between the Sanatana Dharma of India and the great line of Judaic prophets of whom Jesus himself declared himself as a representative. I myself have sometimes wondered, I have a footnote on that one, "Think not that I am come to destroy the law or the prophets. I am come not to destroy, but to fulfill." I myself have sometimes wondered, perhaps not altogether fancifully, whether an etymological connection may not be drawn between the biblical name Abraham and the Hindu concept of Brahma. Less than a month after I met Yogananda and was accepted by him as a disciple, he invited me to join him at his desert retreat at 29 Palms, California. There he dictated a few lessons for his yoga correspondence course. One evening he included, to my amazement, the following information. "The three wise men who came to honor the Christ child after his birth were the line of gurus who later sent me to the West, Babaji, Lahiri Mahashay, and Swami Sirukteswar." Yogananda emphasized at the same time the basic oneness of all religions, all true religions. The fact that he placed particular emphasis on Hinduism and Christianity was not intended by him in any sense to imply exclusivity. I think he selected, or rather was commissioned, to concentrate on these two, because there exists a subtle link, especially between these two religions. Hinduism and Christianity have remained the purest of the mighty streams of God that God has sent to mankind. Of the Semitic religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, Christianity is the purest in the sense that its spiritual traditions still include the saints. And the saints, the truest representatives of Christian truth, have always emphasized the importance of direct inner communion with God as the path to liberation and the infinite. Of the great Eastern religions, Hinduism had its several offshoots, which include Buddhism, Jainism, and Sikhism. The Sanatana Dharma in Hinduism has been the most emphatic regarding the need for inner, direct communion. Indeed, and most importantly, it alone of all religions has emphasized the highest possible attainment, the reality referred to almost always by Jesus when he spoke of heaven and the kingdom of God. Kaivalya Moksha, complete soul liberation and eternal union with God, the infinite and supreme Lord. Indeed, every true religion, one that is not merely man-made, in other words, leads to Kaivalya Moksha, though few Hindus even are aware that this final absolute destiny awaits them at the end of their long journey through the numerous byways of ignorance. That certain religions are not valid in the highest sense should go without saying, for human beings naturally try to figure out for themselves the meaning of life, death, and eternity. It seems eminently improbable, however, that God should have waited thousands of years, the length of time that civilization, as is now believed to have been active on earth, before sending a true revelation. Indeed, many Christians advance as, quote, proof of what Jesus brought was the one true revelation, whereas that of all other teachers of other religions taught before him was merely the fruit of deep philosophical thought. It is undone by the fact that many of those teachers and the religions they founded meet every test one can apply to Jesus Christ. Miracles? In the 18th century, a holy man in India, Sadhu Haridas, was rowing a boat on a lake. His passenger was a Christian missionary. The missionary wanted to convert him to Christian religion. Haridas suddenly challenged him. Is there any miracle your Jesus performed that others cannot perform also? The fact that they were in a boat surrounded by water inspired the missionary to offer as proof the story of how Jesus walked on the water of the Sea of Galilee. Is that all? Sadhu Haridas retorted. He stepped out onto the water forthwith and walked on it. Wherever he went, thus my guru told the story to me, the boat followed behind him. Miracles are not in themselves any proof of saintliness. Certain yogis in the East have been known to possess amazing powers, yet have not been truly deep in a spiritual sense. Haridas himself later fell, so my guru told me, albeit temporarily only, from his spiritual attainments. The true proofs of spirituality are ecstatic absorption in the divine and selfless impersonal love. Such spirituality is evidenced outwardly, as I stated earlier, by complete non-attachment to all things worldly, by unselfish love for all, by unfailing kindness, calmness, and forgiveness, and by the outward manifestations of an unshakable inner bliss. Differences of national outlook must also be borne in mind. Indians, for example, are more contemplative by nature. Americans are more inventive and practical. Julius Caesar, once commenting on the different peoples of Europe, made a few fascinating observations. The Teutons, or Germans of those days, he said, were highly capable and intelligent, and therefore rose rapidly to the top in comparison with other nations. They always failed in the end, however, because they became ensuingly proud of their accomplishments. Thus they fell from those heights. Even today, after 2,000 years, the same assessment might be made. Of the Gauls, the modern-day French said, if five of them happen to be together and four of them agree on some point, the fifth will disagree on principle. Amusingly, that assessment seemed rather true of the French even today. Of the Romans, Caesar said, they are fickle in their loyalties and never cling long to anything or anyone. That, too, was a fair assessment. which might be applied as well to Romans even today. There's a story related of a group from different countries who were assigned the task of writing about the camel. The American flew straight to Cairo, stayed in an expensive hotel, and went out casually to observe a few camels in the streets. He also saw one camel striding along in the desert. Returning home, he wrote his paper based on that direct but superficial experience. The Englishman, more careful with his money, visited the London Zoo and there observed one or two camels. Then wrote a learned treatise complete with footnotes. He based his paper on that slightly more careful observation. The German went to the nearest library and studied whatever facts he could dig up about camels. Then wrote a learned treatise complete with footnotes, but without ever seeing an actual camel. The Indian returned to his room, pulled down the blinds, sat in the lotus pose on the floor, and prayed that God would drop a well-composed paper in his lap. This amusing story was told me, I should add, by a Hindu friend from Calcutta. There is certainly some truth in the comments one hears about the differences of national characteristics. One should indeed be grateful that the differences exist. They lend a certain interesting variety, spice, so to speak, to the panorama of life. There is one such difference between the various nations that has been widely noted and seems also to be generally true. The outlook of Western countries is more materialistic and outward, whereas in the East, and especially in India, it seems to be more mystical and spiritual and in an inward sense. The Eastern view of religion, especially the Hindu, is also inclined to be more impersonal. This view somewhat affects people in their own lives as well. When affliction comes to people everywhere on earth, their tendency is to think first, why me? In the East, however, and especially again in India, this thought is followed more naturally by the thought, light and darkness, pleasure and pain, joy and suffering, such contrasts to the very nature of reality. In the West, the natural reaction after the thought, why me, is to decide something has to be done about it. A Westerner may universalize his reaction also, as people do more typically in the East, but in his case, his way of doing so may be to add, and by no means resignedly, what can be done? Or better still, what can I myself do to improve matters? The Western temperament is by nature executive and more inclined to assume responsibility. The Eastern is more naturally open and accommodating. These two attitudes should be balanced, ideally speaking, for balance is what leads to perfection. It should be pointed out, however, that Jesus Christ was essentially an Easterner. His teachings contain definite undertones of what has been called Eastern fatalism. Consider his counsel, for example, therefore, take no thought, saying, what shall we eat, or what shall we drink, or wherewith shall we be clothed? For after all these things do the Gentiles seek. For your heavenly Father knoweth that ye have need of all these things. Take therefore no thought for the morrow, for the morrow shall take thought for the things of itself. Sufficient unto the day is the evil thereof. Incidentally, that last sentence is another example of his wry wit. One can see him expressing it with a slight smile. This counsel, be it noted, is very different from what one would expect from an American chief executive, in other words, a Gentile. Thus, I suggest again that a study of Eastern religions may provide even Christians with a new and perhaps deeper insight into their own religion. The Eastern view, particularly that which is known as Hinduism, tends especially because of its impersonality to be particularly receptive to the discoveries of modern science. Indians have had no discernible difficulty with the discovery of the vastness of the universe, with the great spans of cosmic time, with the relative insignificance of our planet Earth, and with man's apparent unimportance in the great scheme of things. These relatively new scientific discoveries have not been the challenge to Eastern, and perhaps especially again to the Hindu, perception of reality that they have been to the Christian churches. The Hindu scriptures particularly have always described vast eons of cosmic time. The statement by modern astronomers that the material universe is billions of years old was fully anticipated in India, whose ancient seers held that a day of Brahma, the time span of one cosmic manifestation, lasts billions of years, and is followed by an equally long night of Brahma. According to those teachings, these cosmic days and nights have recurred in endless succession. If we compare that claim with the biblical account of creation, in which God created everything in 6 days, ending with a seventh day of rest, it soon becomes evident why Hindus may, with their view of reality, have found it easier than Christians to accept the actual age of the universe. A corresponding belief in Hinduism, which many Christians have rejected, is the doctrine of reincarnation. Most Hindus take this God doctrine for granted. It fits comfortably into their perception of vast periods of time. Is it not perfectly possible in that vast scheme of things that the duration of our own existence is comparably vast? Christian authorities formally insist that reincarnation is not a Christian teaching. We have already seen, however, that some of Christ's statements do suggest this doctrine. One basic difference between the Western and the and the Eastern view of reality is the way each views cosmic creation. The executive side of human nature acts upon things from without. In this mode, human beings sculpt or mold a statue. They create a painting by placing lines and layers of color on a canvas. They make motors by molding pieces of metal, then screwing or welding them together. Life, by contrast, always grows outward from within. The Eastern view is more naturally inclined to think of creation as a process of becoming. Consider how a human being is formed. First, by the union of two cells, the sperm and the ovum, which then subdivide, ultimately produce the body. Plants grow from little seeds. Life, in other words, manifests altogether differently from the object man produces. As the American poet Joyce Kilmer wrote, "Only God can make a tree." The Indian view of life accommodates itself more naturally to the concept that all things are formed from within, rather than imposed on nature from without. Ancient wisdom claims that God dreamed the universe into existence. In other words, he became the universe, without ever changing even slightly his own aloof, ever-watching nature. Christians have imagined God producing the universe as if out of a hat, like a stage magician. Nowhere, to my knowledge, has the process of creation been deeply pondered. He just made it. What more do we need to know? These words describe most people's way of explaining it all. The Hindu teachings, however, and if you think about it, the New Testament also, give a virtually identical explanation for cosmic beginnings. The first verses of the Gospel of St. John describe God as becoming the universe. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. The same was in the beginning with God. All things were made by him, and without him was not anything made that was made. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. And the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us. These verses contain much food for thought. Although St. John seems at first glance, because of those words, "and dwelt among us," to be referring only to Jesus Christ, everything was in fact made that way. The vibration or word of God's consciousness which manifests the universe became it. It didn't mold it. It may be said indeed to have become it. I'll give Paramahansa Yogananda's explanation more fully in a later chapter. For now, let us contemplate an even more urgent question. What is God? So this is just a small sampling of what this book is about, but I have to say it's I'm all for it. I rarely say that. I'm so excited by this because it's a way of uniting East and West. Our religions, which so often have caused us to feel ourselves separate from other people, The truth of spirituality, the Sanatana Dharma, the eternal truth, is that we are all the same. And indeed, if you travel, you find that people, underneath their obvious differences, they basically all want love, kindness, peace, affection. They all want bliss. We're all motivated by that simple desire for divine bliss. And because we're caught in an ego, we think we define bliss falsely, thinking that bliss is when I have a good steak or a good omelet or a good apple or banana, that bliss is something confined. True, why do we seek things? Why do we seek success? Why do we seek mates? Why do we seek anything? It is always because that little self thinks that that fulfillment of bliss will be contained in that beautiful house, that beautiful wife or husband or whatever. We only think that, but that's because those things represent to us what we feel. The joy we get from them isn't in those things at all. We get it from inside. We have an expectation of finding bliss, and we think for a while we have found it. And every fulfillment in this human body is temporary. It will have to change. Joy becomes suffering. Health becomes illness. All the opposites of the universe are there as long as your mind goes outward. Once you can learn to bring your consciousness inward into yourself. And isn't that what happens too? When you experience joy for a while in your life, or at least fulfillment in your life, you think it'll be forever. But when you lose that, then you think the resulting suffering will be forever. We're neither joy nor suffering. All life, because dvaita means duality, all life is a fluctuation of waves on the surface of the sea of consciousness. And that one spirit creating duality made it possible for this world to come into existence. Your job as seekers of God must be to find that eternal self that is behind. You know, if you trace, if you strip an onion of all its peels, what's left? Nothing. An onion is made up of its peels. And so you strip your ego of its self-definitions. And you finally, in the end, you discover there's nothing. That's why Buddhists got into the mistaken idea that there is no God, or that the end, that nirvana means the end of consciousness. Well, the obvious answer to that is how can something come out of nothing? And that same question must be asked, how can feeling come out of nothing? There can't be a nothingness that everything comes from. When Buddha is described as infinitely compassionate, what it means is that he had attained that state where he's in the sort of reservoir of all feeling. And we also have to understand that the consciousness beyond nirvana is not absolute non-existence. It means no real existence in the forms that we have taken on. God is that infinite potential out of which all love comes. And it's very important to understand that aspect of it, because how do you love something that's just conscious? I mean, I see a computer and I see it can reason things through, but I can't really think of it as conscious. Consciousness, a bliss, and the final thing is the nature of that feeling, the nature of that consciousness is Satchidananda. Chit does not mean just consciousness. It's the bliss is the subtle and underlying reality of all that consciousness. So it's 1 o'clock, and I guess I'll have to stop for now. But I'm so happy to see you all and many friends from many parts of the world. Thank you for coming.